Okay, our topic for tonight is neo-reform. If last week was classical reform, this week is neo-reform. We're moving ahead in time. So the Jazz Age and the Great Depression, 20s and 30s, into a period, was not a good time for religion in the United States in general, not just Judaism. It was not a moment in the history of this country where there was great religious zeal. Religion was perceived by many as an ornament of bourgeois culture, something you indulged in if you had a little kesef and you could pay dues for a house of worship of whatever denomination or whatever religion. But otherwise, people were either enjoying life in the 20s or struggling to get by in the 30s, with God playing limited or no role. From a Jewish point of view, the universities were attracting the Jews, especially in New York, and at the universities, whether it was City College or Hunter or NYU or even Columbia, if you were rich and could get in, agnosticism and atheism were the trends of the day, not old-fashioned religion. From a reform point of view, the reform movement could not shake the image that they were genteel upper-class institutions that demanded little or nothing of their adherents. That was the reputation that they had, and they couldn't shake it, although in some quarters they didn't want to shake that reputation. They liked that reputation. The rabbis who cared about dynamism for the movement were very much chagrined. They complained about apathy, anemia, indifference. There was nothing happening. There was no excitement, no religious fervor among their congregants. And to quote one of them, one of the elite congregants of one of the elite institutions of Reform synagogues in the New York area, quote, "We laymen do not take our Judaism seriously except when a persecuting Gentile world forces us to do so." It's true. All right, it's very true. When the outside world gets angry and gets murderous, then Jewish people who have been indifferent to their identity get closer to their identity. But in this interwar period, some of the leadership of the Reform movement were looking to move beyond being just a boutique denomination for German Jews who've been in the country for two, three, four generations. They wanted the Reform movement to be something much more than that. And Julian Morgenstern played an important role in this. Morgenstern was born in 1881, dies in 1976, was the president of Hebrew Union College from 1922 to 1947. He was the successor to Kaufman Kohler, and he, like Kaufman Kohler, was a believer in God. Now, that's a nice thing for a rabbi to believe in God. But when I say he was a believer in God, I mean he was staunchly a theist at a time when rabbis within the Reform movement and certainly within the Reconstructionist wing of the conservative movement were moving towards religious naturalism and rejecting the notion of a personal God and personal piety. Morgenstern followed in Kohler's tradition. You have to have traditional belief about God, even if not about revelation and ritual. Now, he wanted American Judaism to be united under a Reform banner. Who else wanted that? Two generations earlier, Isaac Meir Wise. Isaac Meir Wise wanted Reform American Judaism to be united in the style that he was promoting, which happened to be Reform, but more importantly, it was his Judaism, because he was a bit of a megalomaniac. But a few generations later, in the days of Julian Morgenstern, could this at all be possible? What prevented the emergence of a unified American Judaism under the banner of Reform in the late 1800s? Two things. First of all, the march towards radicalism on the part of American Reform, something that didn't happen in Europe. Okay, we're talking about very serious departures from tradition, eating of treif, mixed seating in the synagogue, things that were not happening even in the other liberal denominations around the world. So, too radical, so for the traditionalists this was anathema. And the other consideration was a large number of Eastern European Jews start arriving in America. And so the Central European Jews of the 19th century are outnumbered 10 to 1. And you can't rally them to the cause. They're totally in the world apart. That's what prevented a unified American Judaism under Reform. So why does Morgenstern think in the 1920s and 30s he can accomplish what couldn't have been done earlier? The answer is twofold. One, move away from the radicalism, make Reform more Jewish, legitimately Jewish, and secondly, immigration has come to a grinding halt. And therefore, you don't have an influx of traditionalists from Europe who are reinforcing the ranks of American Judaism. And as for the Eastern European Jews who are here already, well, after a decade or two or three or four, they've become Americanized, and they're not interested in immigrant orthodoxy of the Landsmannschaft der Schule. They're looking for a more illustrious house of worship, and maybe it could be even a reform house of worship. So ultimately, Morgenstern's wishes will not be fulfilled during his tenure as president of HUC. However, after World War II, to a significant extent, he'll be proven right that, yes, reform will emerge as the largest of all the denominations. But in his own time, it was still a boutique denomination just for the rich elite. He lived long enough to see a great measure of success. He was alive for a good 30 years after he retired. He lived a very long life. Okay. So,
did he see the assimilation we see today?
Yes, but if you look at things from a reform point of view, assimilation was a constant, even back in the classical period. It's not as though it became any more rampant for his constituency at a later time. If you're a leader of the reform movement, what you're looking to do is increase the number of synagogues under your auspices and the number of members within those synagogues, and that actually happens. The broader fate of American Jewry is a separate question. And on that question, it's a disaster. But from the perspective of institutional success, that was not a disaster. That was a success. So you have to, always have to separate the two questions. They're not the same. All right.
But how could you have the self-perpetuation of 10, 15, 20 years in the reform movement, people get farther and farther away
from... So the solution is move away from the radicalism towards a more positive attitude with respect to ritual, Hebrew, Zionism, Jewish identity. All this is going to come into play tonight in this session. Maybe even kashrus. We'll get to someone. No, it's no joke. We'll get to a reform rabbi who advocates the restoration of kashrus as part of the list of things that reform Jews do. Yeah.
I wonder whether reform Judaism was not the definition of being an American Jew, something uniquely American, which evolved eventually to be accepted, to be American, and be Orthodox, and be conservative. You know, to be observant,
so
is not...
You're on target that much of the gestalt of Reform Judaism is about proving one's Americanism.
Right.
And that will play a role in other denominations that are more ritually observant later on.
Right.
Why is that so important? Well, because historically, since the emancipation, Jews have wanted to not just feel as though they fit in, but show to the external forces that we deserve to be here and we fit in. And we're just like you guys in terms of patriotism.
Okay. It's an accusation against us.
Well, it's an accusation that sometimes isn't even leveled, but we answer it despite it not being leveled against us. It's a very Jewish thing to do, yes, yes. Okay, so this reform, this neo-reform, would differ from classical reform in that it would have a broader understanding of Jewish identity. Classical reform understood Judaism and Jewish identity only as religious identity. Only religious identity, but not a national identity, and arguably not even an ethnic identity, to be honest, because ethnic culture played no role. Religion only. Now, watered down religion without a whole lot of ritual, but religion only. Whereas neo-reform would say, what is a Jew? More than just a member of the Mosaic faith, but a member of a worldwide Jewish people, and maybe even a Jewish nation, God forbid to use the word, because nationalism was anathema to the old reformers.
The force that may have pulled reform away from the abyss was the rise of Zionism.
Correct.
And many of the Zionist leaders here were reform rabbis.
Correct. So last time we mentioned that many of the leading Zionist figures were themselves reform rabbis who were in the fringe minority within their professional guild early in their careers, but because of the persuasion of their arguments and because of the evolving world affairs and the rise of Nazism, their point of view became the dominant point of view within their professional guild, within the CCAR, by the mid-1930s. And we're going to discuss that tonight. So, Yeah.
But you had the Biltmore program in 1939.
The 42. We're going to get to that, yeah.
When you had that program, the most reformed Jewish community did not vote for it. The American Jewish Committee did not vote.
They were lukewarm on... they were tepid on the issues of Zionism in 1942, and they would only become warm towards things in 1947-48. Now, aside from a broader understanding of Jewish identity, neo-reform will have greater traditional practice. So those mitzvot ma'asiot, practical observances, rituals of the synagogue and of the home that were cast aside a few generations earlier as being inappropriate for the modern era because either they look too oriental or they're just too cumbersome or too demanding, they will be brought back. Never in the full halachic sense, but at least to a degree. Symbolism, ceremony, even if not full halachic observance. And lastly, a love of Zion. That whereas the classical position was totally hostile to the restoration of the Jewish community of Eretz Yisrael, let alone the political angle of Zionism, a commonwealth, a state, now neo-reform will certainly be positive towards the Yishuv, and maybe even more than that, maybe even supportive of statehood. Okay.
Now, like, from the other side, did the members of the Yishuv come to the reform movement and ask them for money and support like they did to the Reform?
Okay, in 1929... you have a very key turning point when the Jewish Agency for Palestine is established. Before the Jewish Agency existed, the World Zionist Organization was the main institution that directed the policy of the Yishuv, together with the financial arms, the JNF and the Keren HaYesod. But after 29, the Jewish Agency was the main force, political force, and that was an amalgamation of Zionists and non-Zionists. Not anti-Zionists, but people who were non-Zionists who recognized the growth of a community in Eretz Yisrael, and as a just simple matter of Jewish philanthropy, you have to give, regardless of what the ultimate political outcome will be in Palestine. And so the heavy hitters of the our crowd, of the German American-German Jewish elite, they were added to this Jewish agency as part of a deal to expand the Jewish agency, and it was a success. Because the kesef, the diaspora money, the American dollars, did start flowing considerably to the cause of Eretz Yisrael Jewry. Okay, so one area where there was a change in the reform movement of the interwar period was that of religious education. Religious education was hardly existent in the earlier period. Maybe a synagogue had a Talmud Torah, a Hebrew school, where they learned, a Sunday school we would call it, where the kids learned a minimal amount, wenig Yiddishkeit, as we would say. Except they would use it in German. How do you say that in German? I don't know. Instead of this limited Jewish education, you're going to have a more robust Talmud Torah, where instead of just the Sunday school making you a better person, a better human being, now the Sunday school or the Talmud Torah will make you a more dedicated member of the Jewish people. So it's not just about ethical humanism, as derived from amorphous Jewish citations, but rather you'll really learn to be a Jew. To learn to be a Jew, yeah.
Bar mitzvah, yeah. If they had bar mitzvah, did they have mandatory that the kids had to go to school?
Okay, so confirmation was more popular than bar mitzvah. And I do believe that in certain synagogues, there was enforced compulsory attendance at the educational part of the synagogue for the confirmation class. But unlike the bar mitzvahs of today that overly obsess on liturgical participation, like reading a haftorah, the maftir, the kriyas haTorah, back then that was not the case. That's, I believe, a post-World War II invention of fretting over what's going to be able the boy read his haftorah correctly. It's one of the worst aspects of American Judaism, in my opinion.
Yeah.
16, 15, it depended upon the synagogue. Yeah. Okay. So the key figure in this change in education was a man by the name of Emanuel Gamarin, 1895 to 1962. And he was hired in the late 1920s by the Union of American Hebrew Congregations to be the head of the education department. He was a Benderly boy. Now that expression probably means nothing to you, or maybe it means something to somebody. So Samson Benderly was the head of the Board of Jewish Education of New York in the days of the New York Kehillah, which we haven't discussed. Actually, we discussed it 6 years ago, if you remember. The New York Kehillah was an abortive attempt to unite all of New York Jewry, regardless of religious denomination, and for that matter, even irreligious denomination, in one Kehillah, just like it is in Europe. Just as in Europe, the Jewish community has one Kehillah, so too in America, despite the separation of church and state, and despite the fact that religion is entirely non-compulsory, we have one Kehillah. It existed from 1908 until 1922. Really, it only existed from 1908 to 1914. And it came apart at the seams because it was impossible to unify the Bundists with the Orthodox, with the liberal denominations. It was pulling off more than you could chew. Tafasta maruba, lo tafasta. They couldn't accomplish it. It was too much. But the one thing that survived from that was the BJE, the Board of Jewish Education, which I think still exists under a different name. It's not called the BJE anymore. It's called something else. Yeah? They still give the test on Sunday morning to get into Yeshiva High School. Okay. All right. So the BJE was led by Samson Benderly, who was a forerunner in many ways to Reconstructionism, to Mordechai Kaplan's way of thinking, in that what is important... To be a cultured Jew, a cultural Jew. Religion, whatever you want to believe, theologically, you're free to choose from a range of options. But what should you know? You should know Hebrew. You should be able to speak Hebrew. You should be able to study the Jewish text in the original in an environment that is not an old world cheder, where the Rebbe's smacking you with a stick, but rather in an educational environment that is a modern setting, looks like a real classroom. So he wanted a system of Talmud Torahs around the New York area that were serious, that were rigorous, where you would really learn something and learn Hebrew. And it would be modern in nature. After school, correct. After school. The assumption was that the vast bulk of New York Jewry was not going to go to the day school. There only were a handful of day schools in the 19-teens when this was happening. It was post... public school supplementary.
My husband went Howard Avenue Talmud Torah. Uh-huh. Very rigorous.
So there, in the 1920s and 30s, there were many rigorous such Talmud Torahs, including the high schools. Wow. Yes, yes. My family, they went to Herzliya, Marshalia, Herzliya. All right, okay. So that was the product of Benderly, Samson Benderly. Now, his boys were his... Talmidim, all these Benderly boys got...
They studied Gemara?
Huh?
They studied Gemara?
A little bit, not much though. The Benderly boys were his disciples, most of whom got doctorate degrees in education from either Columbia or from City University, and they went out into the field as directors of these schools. Emmanuel Gamron was one such person. So he's coming from a fairly traditional home and environment, religiously speaking, but he becomes the director of education for the Reform movement. So he was not a Reform Jew by nature. He was an observant Jew personally. In his theology, he was neither here nor there, but he worked for the Reform. And eventually, he became a member of the CCAR, despite not being a rabbi. They had to vote in the convention to make him a member because he wasn't an ordained rabbi. A regular member of the CCAR, despite not being a rabbi. But he was a powerful force, a little bit of a little Napoleon, because he was a short fellow. And he ran the Union of American Hebrew Congregations Education Department for over 30 years. Central Conference of American Rabbis. It's the Reform version of the RCA. Okay, so the students at HUC in Cincinnati had competing influences during the interwar period among their professors. On the one hand, they had Abraham Kronbach, who taught the boys to be uncomfortable with traditional theism and to move in the direction of humanistic religion. Oive. On the other hand, they had Samuel Cohen.
It goes worse than that, because he was one of the founders and one of the leading lights of the American Council of the Jews.
Yes, yes. He was bad in every respect.
He was very bad.
Very bad. So his counterweight was Samuel Cohen, who was the professor of theology, and like Kaufman Kohler, was a steadfast traditional theist. So the boys, while they were getting their ordination in the years in Cincinnati, they didn't really know what was Reform Judaism. There was no one Reform Judaism. There were disparate influences that could pull you in one direction or another, which means every man for himself. When you go out into the world, when they would release the boys from Cincinnati onto the world, a congregation didn't know what it was getting necessarily, as we'll see with bizarre consequences in certain cities, in St. Louis and Boston. Basically, yes. Okay. No, no, no. That was very much rejected. There were calls for a Reform Shulchan Aruch, and it was repeatedly rejected. Okay, but but even Friedhof rejected the notion of a Reform Shulchan Aruch. He encouraged responses, shailos u'tshuvos, to specific questions which would not be binding, but would be recommended as being consistent with the liberal approach to Judaism. That was his attitude. Okay, so there were big scholars in Cincinnati at that time. Unlike in the classical era when basically they were learning from Amaratzim, in this period of time there were big scholars. Okay, J.Z. Lauterbach, Jacob Zalo Lauterbach, who was a musmach of the Hildesheimer Seminary in Berlin, was a Talmud of David Zvi Hoffman, was the professor of Talmud in Cincinnati. That was not a very comfortable fit for Lauterbach, or basically a German Orthodox rabbi, to become the leading figure in Reform Talmudism. But he did it.
A job is a job.
Yaakov Mann was the professor of Jewish history, one of the greats of the game in the interwar period in Jewish history. So they had real scholars teaching there, not just quack theologians. So who were the students? Who was going there? Well, the answer is not the sons of our crowd. You think the Jacob Schiff's of the world sons were going to go into the rabbinate? Forget about it. They're making millions of money hand over fist in the business. So who's going to the rabbinate? The poor sons of Eastern European immigrants.
Orthodox?
Well, so they started out of Orthodox background, but slowly evolved away from that. Okay. Now, there was one rabbi in the Reform movement who was the polar opposite of everything that was going on in classical Cincinnati. And that is Stephen Wise, not one of my heroes. You know, I didn't speak about him last year in the Hero and Villain series because I didn't want to upset anybody. And my own uncle is named after Stephen Wise, right? Stephen's name was named for Stephen Wise. But I'm not a big fan of Stephen Wise because in many ways he was self-serving and pompous and didn't get the job done. Didn't do enough with Roosevelt. That's all those criticisms are accurate.
With adoption agencies.
Huh? They named it after him, yes. So he refused to submit to the control, the lay people's control at Temple Emmanuel. And so he left that pulpit after a very short time and established a free synagogue, which was located at Carnegie Hall on Sundays, and he preached to 1,000 people. So Shabbos was Sunday at Carnegie Hall. In 1922, he pulled an Avi Weiss before there was an Avi Weiss. What did he do? No. He opened up his own rabbinical seminary. Okay, so the Reform version of Chovei Torah was 1922, the Jewish Institute of Religion, J-I-R, as a competitor to HUC. Why did he do it? Answer, he thought that HUC was not producing in the best interests of Am Yisrael, of the Jewish people. Why?
Was he a graduate from there?
No, he was ordained privately in Europe. He never went to a rabbinical seminary.
Was he American born?
He was born in Romania, I believe. And came to America. He came to America when he was a child. His father, Aaron Wise, was a rabbi on the west side of Manhattan, Upper West Side. And he went back to Europe for private ordination and then got his doctorate and went on out into the world. But he never really went to a true place to ordain rabbis. He was an Amoritz, really, Judaically. He didn't know anything. But a great speaker, a great orator, excellent. And on YouTube you can find stuff from the 1930s where you could tell he was an excellent orator. All right. Why did he open up JIR? Because HUC was at that time still under the thumb of Kaufman Kohler, at the end of Kohler's career, and was staunchly anti-Zionist, okay, and was producing rabbis that were not serving the interests of the Eastern European masses of Jews, and Stephen Wise, coming from points further east, and could speak Yiddish, had a greater appreciation of the Eastern Jewish masses that had come to America than the HUC fellows ever could possibly have. He wanted to create a rabbinical school that, like Gamaran did for the Talmud Torahs, to have a broader definition of Jewishness. He wanted to create that for the rabbinical school. Not just Judaism as a religion and to the exclusion of all else, but a broad definition of Judaism and Jewish life. Okay?
Where did he stand theologically? Was he bipolar?
Theologically, theology wasn't a strong point of his. And I say that not to belittle him, but just to say that was not the focus of his life. He was an activist for causes and for the people. His head was not in the clouds theologically, but he certainly was no traditionalist. Certainly not. I mean, if
a single picture of him with a
yarmulke. Right, he never wore a yarmulke ever. And if you remember from last year, what was the story I told about Vladimir Jabotinsky, Zev Jabotinsky, and Stephen Wise? Remember the story I told last year? That they were both in San Francisco in the 1930s, and Stephen, it was a Shabbos morning. They were getting out of the hotel, and they were pulling up towards a cab. And Stephen Wise says to Jabotinsky, "Oh, why don't you come to the temple, the big temple on the hill in San Francisco? I'm giving the sermon today." And so Jabotinsky said, "Well, listen, Rabbi Wise, I come from a traditional family, and it's pasnish to get into a car to go to shul to hear a rabbi give a sermon." So, in any event, that was the competitor to HUC. What ended up happening to JIR? So it was not a very impressive institution. They did not have great Wissenschaft scholars. They were low-level pedagogues who were teaching the boys how to become rabbis. But they survived long enough to merge with HUC. That in the late 40s, just around the time when Stephen Wise died, he died in 1949, there was a merger. So that today, what is the name of the institution? HUC-JIR. Yes. With a campus in New York and a campus in Cincinnati and Jerusalem. And Jerusalem ran to the King David Hotel.
I often wonder, why was the attraction of Cincinnati?
So the answer is there's no attraction other than Isaac Meir Wise was a rabbi there, and when the institution was established, it was going to be under his authority. So it had to be there. Okay. So the institution that is going to be critical in the rise of neo-reform, it's not the place to train rabbis, it's the synagogue. What kind of synagogue is it going to be? It has to be more than just a place for religious services. It has to have a more encompassing view of what a Jew should do and what a Jew should do in a Jewish institution. So, the synagogue center emerges. Now, most people associate the synagogue center with Mordechai Kaplan, with the conservative movement, generally speaking, but Mordechai Kaplan, with the Jewish center on the Upper West Side, 86th Street, being the so-called first ever. That's a false version of history. It's not what happened. The synagogue center movement began with the reform movement. And the first one was in 1901 in the temple in Cleveland. It was the first shul to build a gym. So in my shul, Anshe Shalom and Urishel built the gym in 1963. We were already 6 decades behind the times. But the 1901, a full-fledged gym in the temple in Cleveland. So the classical reformers were obviously opposed to the synagogue center concept. To them, you don't bring secular activities into the synagogue. That's sacrilege.
Even in the reform, for
the classical reformers, the purpose of the synagogue is to worship God. Okay, which, by the way, is very similar to the ultra orthodox in Hungary, who said, "Well, you can't have a wedding in a shul." Why? That even religious activities that are not the worship of God, that are not tefillah, don't belong in the Beit Knesset, in the sanctuary room of the Beit Knesset. Do it in the social hall, but not in the synagogue proper.
Wouldn't a synagogue center be a draw for the community, though?
Of course it would. Of course it would, but bear in mind, and now I'm on the verge of saying something very controversial. for the classical Reform rabbi and classical Reform Jew, Jewish continuity was not the priority. The priority was creating a religion that was to your own taste, irrespective of whether it made sense to that it could be viable door by door, generation to generation. Jewish continuity is an obsession of the rabbis of the post-World War II era in America. Right? It was the national anthem of Park East Synagogue when I was there, the door by door. But it still is, okay? But for the classical reformers, they did not worry about that. They did not worry about it. What should Judaism be? What Judaism should be now? Because we believe this is correct, theologically, morally, not because it is a strategically could survive another decade or another two decades. That's not the way they thought. Okay.
That's why they didn't want the chip.
Philosophical. Maybe they just wanted to pack the house.
Okay, so for some people, packing the house is the only concern. Yes. Now that might be for financial reasons. You want to keep the institution afloat, but it also could be ideological. You say, "What is my ideology? Jewish continuity, which means a shul with 1,000 people in it, regardless whether they came for davening, learning, or bowling. It doesn't matter. They showed up." Okay.
What about they had?
So the neo-reformers have gymnasiums, have lectures, have movies, have social dances, but not the classical. Okay. Okay. Yeah? All right. Now, the Synagogue Council of America was established in 1926, and it was supposed to be an organization that could encompass all the denominations. Now, from an Orthodox point of view, the big machlokes over the years is whether it's permissible, whether it's mutter or usser to join the Synagogue Council of America, with the right-wing Rosh Yeshiva saying, you're not allowed. In 1956, they made a big ban, you're not allowed to join the Synagogue Council. And the more moderate Rosh Yeshiva, whether of YU or elsewhere, said, it's permissible to join the Synagogue Council. But from a Reform point of view, what's the purpose of this? Answer: well, in the classical phase, the Reform synagogue and the Reform movement was miles and miles apart from all the other Jews. And they don't want that anymore. We want to be able to be biyachad, Klal Yisrael, together, at least under some umbrella organization. So for the neo-reformers, the Synagogue Council of America makes sense. It's a desirable concept. And it's also doable because they're no longer such extremists in the realm of religion.
What's the OU's position?
The OU, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what it is today. Yeah.
Does that give them validity that they say, even though we're all the way off on the left, we're still at the table?
Everyone wants to be at the table, so it does give someone a little validity. But that said, the old timers in the CCAR, who adhered to 19th century style Reform Judaism, they're not so quick to give up on their ways and to cave into the new brand of reformers who are more favorably disposed towards ritual. And so I'll just give you one example where they flexed a little muscle. In 1931, the Synagogue Council of America had to vote on whether or not it was to be advised that all communal dinners serve kosher food. It's a big issue, you know. The 92nd Street Y served a treif dinner last year, 2 years ago, and it was a big brouhaha. Remember that?
B'nai Brit. 30 years ago, mandated that all the meetings have to be kosher.
So in 1931, the CCAR vetoed a resolution requiring kosher for communal dinners. Why? Because they ate treif and they didn't want to have to impose religion on their constituency. So that was the old style reform, still believing in a hostility to religious observance.
But that's imposing non-religion on others also.
You're right, but that's okay. All right. In the 1920s, some of the lay people regarded Reform Judaism as a mere theological shell, that there was nothing left to it. And the menorah movement became very popular among Jewish intellectuals, which was entirely devoid of religion. It was a campus movement of thinkers, people who had deep thoughts, who wrote great articles about Jewish life, but no religion involved. Menorah, it's a nice Jewish word. No menorah, but it's a menorah journal. So Abba Hillel Silver, one of the leading lights of the neo-reform, who, by the way, on ritual issues was still very much anti-observance, but on Zionism and on Hebrew and on Jewish peoplehood, it was of the new variety. He wrote a counter article to the menorah crowd, Why Does the Heathen Rage? Meaning, you folks who think you're going to sustain Jewish identity by culture alone, intellectual culture alone, devoid of religion, you're wrong. You'll have a nice time, and you'll have a nice intellectual outlet, but your children won't be Jewish, your grandchildren won't be Jewish. You can't sustain Judaism on culture and intellectual life alone. There needs to be an element of religion. Okay. Genius, sir. Okay.
Was he a theist or not?
Yes, he was, absolutely. In the 1920s... I don't know. That's an interesting question. I wonder whether Abba Hillel Silver was related to Eliezer Silver.
No.
They were not related?
I researched that. No.
They're not related. Okay. All right. Okay.
There are streets in Israel, Abba Hillel.
Oh, sure. He deserved it. He was a big Zionist. Now, Abba Hillel Silver complained that people were ignoring religion, but most importantly, that the men were ignoring religion. And he has a very sexist quote that I'll just bring here because it's interesting. He said, "The essential work of the liberal synagogue was largely in the hands of women and ecclesiastics, giving the program an air of isolation and irrelevance." So he was mocking the women, but he was also mocking the rabbis, basically saying that the male component of the laity are the important people, and they're not involved in the slightest. Only the women and the rabbis hang out in the shul. Yeah. Okay, so the education of women in the reform movement was the same as the education of the boys. I didn't have to mention girls because there was no gender distinction. For an Orthodox setting, if this topic was about the haters of the traditional world, then you'd be right to wonder where what happened to the girls. But if for this whole topic, until you get to the level of rabbinic ordination where women are still out until the late 1960s, for Talmud Torahs, boys and girls, the same. Okay. Now, the Union of American Hebrew Congregations, in this era of reform irrelevance and apathy and lethargy, was scaling back its activities. In one area of campus life, they used to be heavily involved, but they gave up and let Hillel take over. In another area of political advocacy, where their representatives in New York and Washington, which was a holdover from the Board of Delegates of the 19th century, gave way to the ADL of B'nai B'rith. So Reform Judaism, because it really did not have much of a membership at that time, the total numbers were quite small, was scaling back, focusing only on purely religious activities and in the synagogue, not branching out, as it tried to in the earlier stages, to the realm of politics or the realm of intellectual life in the campus.
Where are we now, the 20s?
20s and 30s, yeah. During the Depression, it was a big problem. A lot of rabbis, not a lot of jobs. There was an unholy scramble for pulpits. Those were the words of Julian Morgenstern, an unholy scramble for pulpits. Why? Well, number one, existing synagogues sometimes closed for lack of financial resources. Other synagogues stayed open, but realized that rabbis were dispensable. You could function just with lay leadership. You don't need a guy collecting a salary and delivering a sermon. You just function without a rabbi. And new synagogues were not being established, because even though Jews were moving to new neighborhoods, the money wasn't there to build a big edifice. Okay. The Union for American Hebrew Congregations, we basically reached a low point in the 30s in the Depression, but then it had a resurgence under Maurice Eisendrath, who was hired in the late 30s and was for the next three decades had an illustrious career as the head of the union. And he brought life to the party, and he changed the union from what basically had become a mail order religious service. They were just mailing out books and propaganda literature, into something a lot more serious. And also, the literature changed its topics. Instead of being about social justice, forget that. Let's cater to the Eastern European Jews who are now less frum and write about Yiddish culture, Yiddish literature, Jewish topics like a good Jewish magazine would have. Not just social justice, which is universal and devoid of parochialism. Okay. Some of the lay leaders were embarrassed by the radicalism of the rabbis, of the neo-reform rabbis, with their call for social justice and their involvement in the political issues of the day. The CCAR was the first clergy organization in America of any religion to support the dissemination of birth control. Now, that might not sound like an important thing, but it's just an example of them being ahead of the curve on the culture wars of the United States. Way ahead of the curve. They were pacifists in the 1930s, but were patriotic supporters of the war after Pearl Harbor. Now, that I want to explain something. That might not seem like so relevant a point, but it tells you everything you need to know about Reform Judaism in America. They're always wrong until they get it right. In other words, on every major issue, they're wrong first, and then they get it right. On matters of Zionism, on matters of Hebrew, the importance of ritual, on the broader status of Jewish identity, on matters of war and peace, on matters of the existence of the State of Israel, on almost every major issue, they hold a position which history would say was the wrong position, and then they change it and get it right. But at least they change it and get it right. Not every group has the flexibility to do that. Some groups are dogmatically entrenched and can never change their position. Okay. Christian Science was quite popular among Jews in the 1920s and 30s. Why, I don't know, but it was. The numbers bear this out.
They were always giving medical advice.
Okay, yes. They were giving medical advice, and the Reform movement had to respond to this, to the popularity of Christian Science. There were more Jews interested in Christian Science than there were members of Reform synagogues.
So what is Christian Science?
Mary Baker Eddy. It's one book. You go to they have the Beis Hamikdash in Boston, and I was there. There's a Sfarim store, but they're Goyish Cup. I'll tell you why. You go to a Jewish Sfarim store. There are 1,000 different books to buy. So you walk out with a big pile. You spend a lot of money in the Christian Science reading room. There's only one book by Mary Baker Eddy. So you walk out with only one book. You pay $10. You leave. How does the store make money? I don't know.
Reading rooms and all that.
And they're all over the world.
Yeah.
So any idea what they
do? There is, yeah. I didn't know.
Yeah.
So Christian Science was very popular. The Reform have to respond to it. One of the responses was to advocate for religiotherapy and spiritual healing in the Reform synagogue, which turns the Reform rabbi into a bit of a quack. Some people went for it. Others did not. Others found it objectionable within the Reform laity. But Hebrew Union College decided in 1937 to offer the first course in pastoral psychology. They wanted the rabbis to be aware of the eccentricities of the lay person, and to be able to deal with the bizarre nature of the congregational rabbinate and the weird things you have to encounter, and be able to handle it within the bounds of Judaism, or Judaism as they saw it, and not to have to resort to external ideas from weird sources like Christian Science. Okay.
But what is it that
Jesus said? I have no idea. No idea. Hello. Yeah, Jewish Science. Yeah. I don't know. Now, in 1935, the composition of the Reform Rabbinate had changed sufficiently that it was time for a new platform. It was time for a new platform. The Pittsburgh platform was 50 years old at that point. And at the convention, David Phillipson got up and gave a history lecture. He was one of only two survivors from the Pittsburgh Conference still alive. So he was an old man at that point, still hanging around, still a functioning rabbi in Cincinnati. And he gave a history lecture, and he was a great scholar of the history of the Reform movement. He wrote the book on it before this one came out, Michael Meyer, in the 1990s. The original one was The Reform Movement in Judaism by Phillipson in 1907. So he wrote it. He gave a lecture. And at the end of the lecture, he conceded the following point, that the classical doctrines of Pittsburgh no longer appeal to most of the Reform rabbis, but they still appeal to him. But he knows that he's in the minority. He recognizes that he's in the minority. And in 1937, a new platform is issued, which focuses on Torah, God, and Israel as the three pillars of Judaism. It shows the influence of Mordechai Kaplan and Reconstructionism, but also is a pushback against Reconstructionism. So now let me read a little bit from the Columbus Platform of 1937. Okay. One, the nature of Judaism. Judaism is the historical experience, religious experience of the Jewish people. Stop. Already you see Kaplan and anti-Kaplan. It's the historical experience of the Jewish people. Yes, that's Kaplan. But it's a historical religious experience, which is anti-Kaplan. Because Kaplan would say, not just religion, but culture, ethnicity, the whole package. So it's a little bit pro, a little bit con. Though growing out of Jewish life, its message is universal, aiming at the union and perfection of mankind under the sovereignty of God. Okay, so growing out of Jewish life means that it has to be grounded in a real Jewish experience, but that it goes past that and becomes universal. So who would say that it doesn't become universal? The Frumma Yidden, in other words, the immigrant Orthodox, and even the Americanized Orthodox. We're not worried about the wider world. We're a bunch of parochial types who just focus about our own religiosity. But for the Reform, no. It has to have a more universal appeal. All right? Then, Reform Judaism recognizes the principle of progressive development in religion and consciously applies this principle to spiritual as well as cultural and social life. So the cultural and social life angle would have been absent from 1885. It's present in 1937. All right? But the idea of progressive development was true throughout. What is it saying? That we're never going to have a final creed or credo of Reform Judaism. There will always be the option for amending it at a later date in light of developing times. Okay, God. Very important, God. The heart of Judaism and its chief contribution to religion is the doctrine of the one living God, who rules the world through law and love. In him all existence has its creative source, and mankind its ideal of conduct. Though transcending time and space, he is the indwelling presence of the world. We worship him as the Lord of the universe and as our merciful Father. How does this differ from 1885 Pittsburgh?
He's not there.
Okay, so if you remember, 1885 Pittsburgh never affirmatively said anything about God. It said there's a God idea and that the Jewish version of the God idea is better than the Goyim's version of the God idea. But it never said anything about an independent existence of an actual God. It was only a human idea, whether true or false, but a human idea. Here in Columbus, it says it's an idea of humankind, okay, but then it actually avows a belief, a real belief, a sincere belief in the creator of the world, a Ribono Shel Olam. That didn't happen 50 years earlier. Okay. Man. Judaism affirms that man is created in the divine image. His spirit is immortal. He is an active co-worker with God. As a child of God, he is endowed with moral freedom and is charged with the responsibility of overcoming evil and striving after ideal ends. So what does that mean? It means, very simply, that it's a humankind always has to struggle with the Yetzer Hara. In the 19th century, what was the assumption? That that humankind was going on a rapid pace towards universal human brotherhood and a wonderful future. Whereas this is saying, maybe we'll get there, maybe we won't. But there's always going to be a struggle against evil.
What year?
1937.
Well, come on, 2 years.
Oh, okay. All right, so, yeah. Because in America, it was largely absent.
But in Europe?
In Europe, it was there. But for the guys hanging out in western Pennsylvania, who's bothering them? Nobody. I mean, I'm not poo-pooing anti-Semitism in America. It always existed, but it was always a marginal phenomenon. Okay, 4. Torah. God reveals himself not only in the majesty, beauty, and orderliness of nature, but also in the vision and moral striving of the human spirit. Revelation is a continuous process, confined to no one group and to no one age. Yet, the people of Israel, through its prophets and sages, achieved unique insight in the realm of religious truth. The Torah, both written and oral, enshrines Israel's ever-growing consciousness of God and the moral law. Yada, yada, yada. Oral law. Would the fellas hanging around David Einhorn and Kaufman Kohler ever have made reference to the Torah Shebaal Peh? Never. So, at least in English, but it's a Torah Shebaal Peh is referenced in this platform. It shows a trend towards a tradition that is shocking, to say the least, in my view. But more importantly than that, it says that through the prophets and sages, Israel achieved unique insight. So everybody might have their own, other religions might have their own moral teachings, and maybe we find them to be impressive, or maybe we don't. But whatever else is out there, we've done even better. So yes, Pittsburgh said the same thing about the God idea. This is saying it about Torah, about rules, whether ritual, moral rules. Our guide for conduct, if you could say there is a guide within the Reform context, is better than anybody else could ever produce. Okay. Then Israel. Judaism is the soul, of which Israel is the body. Living in all parts of the world, Israel has been held together by ties of common history and above all by the heritage of faith. We recognize in group loyalty of Jews who have become estranged from our religious tradition a bond which still unites them with us. We maintain that it is by religion and for religion that the Jewish people has lived. The non-Jew who accepts our faith is welcomed as a full member of the Jewish community. Okay, so the business of the non-Jew who accepts the faith just means we're favorably disposed towards Gerim, towards converts. But this is a very critical paragraph. What it's saying is that even for Jews who don't believe in religion, the socialists, the Bundists, the communists, the assimilated crowd, who are not Orthodox, not conservative, not Reformed, they don't have any religious affiliation, but they feel very Jewish, and they are Jews, we're still united with them. And that's something that the classical Reform period would have poo-pooed as being insignificant. That what is Judaism? It's a religion alone. If you're not affiliated, if you're not a believer, then what are you? You're nothing. But more importantly, this platform says you can't have Judaism without Jews. Very, very important. You can't have Judaism without Jews. So if we ignore the fate of Jewish continuity and the identity of the people, preserving the concept of Jewish identity, then the religion will die because there'll be nobody to be part of that religion. So that is seems like a pretty obvious point, but within a Reform context was a bit of a chidush, a novelty, a very important one at that. Okay.
The Reform movement by those principles now?
Largely, yes, but there was a successor platform in 1976 in San Francisco. Maybe in a week or two we'll get to that. Although that's a little boring. I kind of lose interest in the Reform movement after about the 1950s.
What made them change? What was
the world is changing. It's becoming a more hostile place. The demographics of American Jewry are changing. They're Eastern European, not German. And
the Holocaust
eventually, but it's something else also. Institutions and movements don't want to die. They like to survive. So, if you have a way of thinking that is not conducive to long-term survival, you divorce yourself from that line of thinking and create something which is more realistic for long-term success. And that's basically what's happening. Reformed temples in the United States, which are empty most of the year in 1902 in the Midwest, because nobody really is religious in the traditional sense anymore. If they want to function, what do they have to have? New members. They want to have new members. They have to cater to a different category of people for whom religion is something very different. It's Jewishness, not just a German preacher teaching Mosaism.
How many of the people who were there in 1902 were still there in 1930?
Almost nobody.
Nobody. Assimilated, their children most popular.
Gone.
Is
that what dawned on them finally?
Yes, yeah, in large measure. Okay, so let's continue. Now, what happens after this platform? Well, there's a need for a new prayer book. Because after all, the Old Union prayer book was very non-traditional, hardly any Hebrew, mostly English, had a theology which was outdated. It sounded like, quote, it was written by retired philanthropists and amateur social workers. That's what it was, the Union Prayer Book. People didn't want logic in their prayer book. They wanted mystery. What is religion if not mystery, the unknown? We want something mystical, not just seichel. For seichel, I can go to the university. For mystery, I turn to religion. So they had to change the prayer book. 1940, they have a new Sabbath prayer book. 1945, a high holiday machzer. What's noticeable about these new books is an increase in Hebrew, and even more importantly than just the Hebrew, ritual. lulav, shofar, Friday night candles, kiddush. So both synagogue rituals that had been frowned upon earlier and home rituals, candlelighting, a basic of Judaism. Only a tiny percentage of the Reform lady was lighting candles 100 years ago. Okay, kiddush Friday night, a basic. They brought it back. More emphasis on symbol and ceremony.
They brought it back in the house?
In the house and in the synagogue.
In the synagogue, we know that.
But even in the house, at least the prayer book instructs the layperson while at home to do X, Y, and Z that in the earlier version of the prayer book was simply missing.
Do Reformed Jews have a Friday night Suda?
I would hope so.
Mordecai Kaplan was he had CJI, the Central
Jewish Institute. Yeah.
He had a camp.
Yes, I know. There's an illustrious graduate of that camp sitting here tonight. Or two of them, actually, then. My father. Yeah. So the kippah and the tali did make a return in some places. Now, the classical Reform rabbis who were still alive, they were turned off by this. And they said, our movement is becoming indistinguishable from conservatism. Oh, shanda. And some of them stopped coming to the annual convention because they felt like they were losers, that they were on the losing end of all the arguments.
How old were they about that time?
These guys are in their 70s.
Okay.
They're getting on in years, but they're still functioning, they're still working, but they don't like going to the convention because the younger fellows have a different attitude than they do. In 1937, Felix Levy, a Zionist, is president of the CCAR, and he wants to return to halakha. Now, not real halakha, but much more rigorous observance. Solomon Freehoff, as Alan mentioned, who was the head of the Responsive Committee of the Reform, said, first we obey God's commandments, and then we learn to understand God's nature. We do not begin with theology, we arrive at theology. Meaning, don't pontificate high-in-the-sky thoughts about what Judaism is. Do a little Judaism, and you'll come to know what Judaism is. All right. William Broyd was a rabbi in Providence, and in 1942, he told the CCR convention that Reform rabbis should keep kosher, they should stop driving on Shabbos except for shul and bikur cholim, and they should daven each morning a quasi-traditional liturgy, and that Hebrew Union College students should spend 1 year in yeshiva. He was laughed out of the room. Now, but it's a where does this come from? So he was born in Lithuania, had a traditional upbringing, became a Reform rabbi, but saw that, you know what, the Reform rabbi, it needs to, a little kick in the pants, they need to become more frum. All right.
What's his name again?
William Broyd.
Broyd.
On Zionism, the CCR membership was evolving from anti to pro. In 1932, Stephen Wise pushed for Hatikva to be put in the Union hymnal. They were revising the hymnal, and he said, excuse me, why is Hatikva not here? And that was like opening up Pandora's box. He got a lot of pushback, but in the end he was successful. They put it in the hymnal. In 1935, when Levy was elected president, he first had a Zionist in the office of the presidency. But because there was such a machlokes over Zionism, they had to have a vote that said that the CCR, as a rabbinical body, will be officially neutral on Zionism. We recognize they're a pro, they're a con, we don't want to divide this organization and tear it asunder, so we'll be officially neutral. In 1942, that neutrality ended in favor of a positive attitude towards the Biltmore program and towards the Jewish army. And that led to the breakaway of the American Council for Judaism in 1943, which was the last stand of the classical reformers.
Now,
Peter Bergson. So, in 1937, Samuel Shulman, who was the rabbi of Temple Emmanuel, the big house, on 5th Avenue and 65th, he said, you know what? Why did Reform Judaism always oppose Zionism? Because of its secularism. So what should we do? Why don't we send out a dozen young rabbis from Cincinnati, newly ordained, to Eretz Yisrael to teach liberal Judaism to the Israeli Jewry, to the Yishuv. That sounds like a crazy idea in hindsight, 80 years later. But that's what he thought. Let's teach liberal Judaism to the secular Jews of the Yishuv. It never happened, and the fate of liberal Judaism in the state of Israel is, you know, a sorry state of affairs to this day. But it was an interesting idea. No one had thought of it before. Why should we be so hostile to them because they're atheists? Let's turn them into us. Instead, they should have religion, not Orthodox religion, but our religion. Never happened. Okay. Running out of time. Well, let's go a few minutes over tonight. So, Abba Hillel Silver said the following. The universalism of Reform Judaism and its hostility to Zionism over the years was not prophetic. Their universalism was not prophetic. It was Pauline. In other words, Christian. That Judaism and Jewish identity needs to be inwardly focused, and so therefore, don't worry about changing the world. Worry about what? Saving Jewish lives and building up a Jewish state.
And now you have the reverse. Tikkun Olam
changed it in the 1960s and 70s. But Hillel Silver, Abba Hillel Silver, wanted to flip it around from, instead of universal, inwardly focused. Okay. Last point for tonight. When the American Council for Judaism was established, it was strong in the South and in the West, not in the North and in the East. And it was hostile to Zionism, viciously anti-Israel from 1948 to 1967, led by Elmer Berger, whom I discussed a few years ago when we discussed anti-Zionism. It was never a very large group. It was a fringe phenomenon in American Jewish life. But the worst of the worst, if we're in the business of spreading a little Lashon Hara, was the Hebrew congregation, Beth Israel of Houston. They saw the handwriting on the wall about Reform Judaism, that it was evolving from classical to neo, and they developed two categories of membership, the higher-ranking members and the lower-ranking members. And you had to be approved in order to be a higher-ranking member, which had voting privileges, because they didn't want the Eastern European types, who were the neo-reform, to change the character of the shul away from its classical bent. Okay? They believed in very limited ritual, almost no Hebrew in their liturgy. They were hostile to social justice. They favored Jim Crow. They wanted the Red Cross to separate white and black blood donations.
Really?
Yes. They complained. They complained that the Hebrew Union College taught the students too much Hebrew. Can you believe that? That the rabbis were learning too much Hebrew in the ordination school.
Where did they get the separation of
the blood? So they were real old-fashioned Southern racists who happened to be Jews.
Right.
And
who were hated by the people they supported.
Okay, so Freehoff, Salomon Freehoff, who became the president of the CCAR in the 1940s, early 40s, he attacked them as a loathsome brand of cowardly anti-Judaism who were saboteurs and dangerous to the fate of the Jewish people. That's good language. Good, strong language from Freehoff attacking the bigots from the South. So I just give that as an example that some Jews in this country, only a small, small portion, retain that classical reform approach towards liturgy, towards Zion, Hebrew, but were not social justice warriors. They were a product of their time and place, and if that time and place was apartheid and bigoted, so were they. That ceased to exist, it came and went, but it had its place in time in American Jewish history. We'll stop here.